The men will leave their knapsacks with the wagons and will carry 3 days' rations. Arms will be put in perfect order. All cartridge cases will carry 40 rounds, with 20 additional rounds carried by the men in their pockets. Commanders of batteries will see that limber and caisson boxes are filled to their utmost capacity. With the bridge completed and all preparations made, the Army of the Potomac launched its big attack on the nerve center of the Confederate government. Private Thompson and his fellow soldiers were hoping for a quick, clean victory, but that wasn't to be. The Southern troops, fighting for a cause they believed noble and just, resisted fiercely. For days, the battle raged back and forth, in and around the river. Finally, a Union corps under General Fitz John Porter won several key victories and cut the railroad lines carrying supplies to Richmond. Things looked promising for McClellan, until nature took an unexpected hand. A great storm hit the peninsula. Sheets of rain fell night and day, flooding the valley and turning the calm river into a raging torrent. Mud on the Richmond Road was over a foot deep. The storm badly damaged the new Union Bridge and wrecked a second bridge that was being built. By June, the rebels had been well reinforced and were able to counterattack. The Union troops lost ground before Richmond, and the battlefield became fragmented, with pockets of men fighting everywhere. During those weeks, Private Thompson's work took a new turn. Headquarters had been impressed with his success as a spy and also with his horsemanship. He was a fine rider, skilled and daring, and good messengers were badly needed. So, to the complete annoyance of Dr. Hodes, Frank Thompson was again called from the hospital, this time to be a special courier for the Union generals who were directing the confused fighting. Mounted on Rebel, Private Thompson traveled the countryside for days, carrying orders and dispatches through swamp and mud, over rain-drenched fields and across streams swollen into rivers. Rebel was equal to every demand made on him, and Thompson enjoyed the excitement of his role. He also had a share of narrow escapes. Once, coming back from a mission, the courier fell in with a Union cavalry patrol. There were four troopers, and Franklin was glad to have company. Suddenly, shots flew at them from the nearby foliage. The patrol was being ambushed, not by the enemy, but by a band of renegade soldiers. Renegades, found on both sides, were armed guerrilla bands who operated without orders, completely on their own. Also called bushwhackers, they were supposed to be partisans of either the North or the South, but most of the time they were merely pirates, preying on civilians and soldiers, killing, robbing, and looting for their own gain. Private Thompson and his cavalry friends were outnumbered, but in the confusion were able to fight their way out of the trap. Several of the men were wounded, and Rebel received a gash across his flank, but he managed to limp back to camp with Franklin, where his minor wound was lovingly attended to. Another time, heading home near Rebel territory, Thompson decided to take a shortcut. Riding through an unfamiliar area, he somehow lost his way. Then, across a large open field, he spotted a column of Federal troops marching by. They were unmistakable in their blue uniforms. With a whoop, he turned the chestnut and cantered in their direction. Several men waved to him, and he waved back in greeting. Suddenly, a squad of enemy cavalrymen came charging out of the woods. Franklin realized in alarm that the soldiers in blue were prisoners. They hadn't been waving to him, but trying to warn him away. More enemy troopers appeared. Thompson wheeled his horse and headed back the way he had come, but another squad came charging at him. Turning again, he galloped toward the far end of the wide field, the only escape route still open. Slowly, his pursuers closed the gap. They began firing, and he heard shots whining past his ears. Then he felt a harsh sting in his right arm. Looking down, he saw that his sleeve was torn and blood was seeping out. His arm began to throb, but he gripped the reins tightly and kept going. Then Thompson froze. Directly ahead was a ditch wide and deep, and there was no way around it. He'd never jumped Rebel before. Now he had no choice. Leaning over the little horse's flying mane, he dug in his heels and whispered, "Up and over, Reb, up and over." The ditch came closer and closer. The chestnut lifted high into the air. Thompson held his breath, leaning forward to keep himself balanced. There was a moment of peril as Rebel scrambled for his footing on the far side. Then on he galloped. Thompson patted Rebel proudly on his arched neck and looked back. His pursuers had pulled up short, unwilling to risk the jump for just one more prisoner. Horse and rider found their way home at last. Naturally, Emma wanted to avoid the hospital, where she'd have to remove her shirt so her wound could be tended. Instead, she headed straight for the chaplain's cabin. Mrs. Butler, by now an expert nurse, cleaned and dressed the injured arm. "That ball nicked the flesh and went through," she said. "Nothing to worry about, my dear. You'll be fine." Over a cup of coffee, Emma finally began to relax. "Thank you, Mrs. Butler," she sighed. "Guess I was mighty lucky." The chaplain's wife shook her head anxiously. "You surely were," she said. "This time." Chapter 12, June 10th, 1862. The colonel signed the furlough papers and handed them to Private Thompson.
"You've earned a good rest," he said. "Take 2 weeks. Look after that arm of yours."
Thompson thanked him, saluted, and hurried to the hospital, where he packed a small knapsack. His arm was sore, but healing well, and he looked forward to his holiday. A supply wagon train was just leaving for Fort Monroe, and he hitched a ride as far as Williamsburg, a peninsula city occupied by the Union. For a few days, as Private Thompson, Emma explored the city, taking in the sights and sounds. But after months of danger and battle, civilian life seemed dull. She was soon bored and spent the rest of her leave doing volunteer nursing. There were two main hospitals in Williamsburg, filled with the sick and wounded. One hospital was for Union men, the other for Confederates. Emma saw no difference and divided her time equally between the two. As far as she was concerned, wounds were wounds and pain didn't play favorites. The war was a necessity, yes, but the price, the human price, was very high. Moving through the crowded wards, tending the rows of maimed and suffering men, she grieved for them all. But she kept in mind a prayer Major Butler had taught her. As the nurse worked, she repeated it to herself, gaining strength. "Grant us grace to share in others' woes, and when their dreams or hopes begin to fade, help our hearts to feel and our hands to aid." By the end of the furlough, Emma's arm was healed and she returned to camp fit and healthy, just in time for the final battle of Richmond. By now, the Confederate armies had been greatly strengthened and had a new commander, General Robert E. Lee. The fighting, later known as the Seven Days Battles, raged back and forth, swirling around places called Mechanicsville, Fraser's Farm, Gaines's Mill, and Malvern Hill. In the end, the Union forces were completely stopped. McClellan's battered army had to withdraw to the west and dig in along the James River. But Union troops were now needed elsewhere, and Frank Thompson's regiment, the 2nd Michigan, was sent to the Shenandoah Valley. Here they joined the Federal Army of Virginia under General John Pope. At first, the spy was alarmed, until she learned that Major and Mrs. Butler were being transferred too. Hearing that, she breathed a sigh of relief. At the new field hospital, Thompson's work went on as usual, but his reputation had followed him, and soon he was at headquarters again, serving as a special courier. The rebel commander facing them was the daring, brilliant officer, General Thomas Stonewall Jackson. It was vital for Pope's aides to learn everything they could about Jackson's campaign plans, and before long, Private Thompson was sent off again on spying missions. Now that he was in a new zone, he felt it was safe to revive an old favorite. Several times in the hectic months that followed, he slipped behind enemy lines disguised as a small, woolly-haired black man in ragged overalls, the amiable, good-natured Cuff. To Emma Edmonds, Cuff had almost become a real person. I truly admire the little fellow, she confided to Mrs. Butler, darkening her skin with solution and peering into the mirror. He's a plucky one. Got his share of grit. In the glass, she saw Mrs. Butler grinning, realized what she'd said, and they both began to laugh. In August, the two sides began skirmishing for a rail junction known as Orange Courthouse. Asked to find out more about the enemy's plans, Emma remembered the black women she'd seen at Richmond. She tinted her skin again, put on an old blouse, apron, and ragged skirt, and tied a bandana around her head. She'd heard that a small group of contraband slaves, lonely and homesick, had asked to be returned to the southern sector. Carrying a basket of laundry, she quietly joined this group and passed with them through the rebel pickets. Emma spent the whole next day in the Confederate camp, washing and sewing for the rebels. By now, she was an expert at keeping eyes and ears open and picked up valuable data. Late that afternoon, she found herself alone in the wash tent. As she sponged and cleaned an officer's dress coat, a packet of official documents slipped from the inside pocket. The black woman was excited. She swooped on the papers and quickly hid them under her skirt. Emma's heart was pounding. She'd made a great find. How could she get home quickly? Leaving the coat on its hanger, neatly cleaned, she hurried toward the slave quarters. Not far away, a battle zone was being shelled. Emma had to act before the loss of the papers was discovered. So without stopping, she slipped into this dangerous battlefield. Then she hid in the cellar of an abandoned farmhouse. She had no idea what would happen next. Would the rebels come after her? Would she be killed by a shell? She crouched in the dark cellar and waited. All night, as she tried vainly to sleep, cannon shells and gunfire roared and crashed. Several times the old house shook with explosions, but somehow it remained standing. In the morning, Emma found that her luck had held. A troop of federal cavalrymen overran the area, and Emma was free to come out of hiding. With some difficulty, the strange black woman convinced the surprised troopers that she was a Union agent. Once she was cleared, she rushed to headquarters and turned over the precious papers. Another time, a patrol captured two enemy horsemen from Kentucky. These Kentuckians, who had gone over to the rebel cause, all wore unique uniforms, pants and fringed jackets made of tan buckskin. Because of the color of their clothes, the men were called butternuts. With the chaplain's help, Private Thompson obtained one of these outfits and for several days roamed the enemy front as a Kentucky butternut, collecting more information. For many months, this pattern continued. Private Thompson divided his time between hospital and headquarters, risking his life on spy assignments. Winter came, and with it, much cold and hardship for the troops. Twice, while riding rebel on courier trips, Franklin suffered frostbitten feet. His ailments were very painful, but they never stopped him. He was doing what he wanted to do, playing a part in the great war effort, and even the imp voice was quiet. At the end of the year, Private Thompson and the Butlers were transferred again, this time to the 9th Corps under General Ambrose Burnside near Louisville, Kentucky. And while at this new post, Emma took on the toughest mission of her entire career. Chapter 13, February 17, 1863.
If I had a cow that gave such milk, I'd clothe her in the finest silk. I'd feed her on the choicest hay and milk her 40 times a day. Ha, 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 you and me, little brown jug, how I love thee. Ha, 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 you and me, little brown jug, how I love thee.
Couple skipped to this lively polka, played by the Kentucky Militia Band. Candles glowed from chandeliers. Servants passed goblets of wine and punch to the guests. And in a side room, beautiful tables were heaped with sandwiches, pastries, and fruit. The gala at the State House was a glittering event. All Louisville society was there. Most of the young men wore blue dress uniforms of the Union Army. The older ones looked dignified in frock coats and ruffled shirts. But it was the women who added color and elegance in their fine hoop skirts, elbow-length gloves, and gleaming jewels, with fans and dance cards dangling at their wrists. From the festive look of things, it was hard to tell that Kentucky was in the middle of a grim war. At that very moment, rebel forces under General John Morgan were carrying out guerrilla raids, and there was skirmishing near Louisville. But none of it seemed to bother the partygoers. Two debutantes perched on gilded chairs were sipping punch and eyeing a slender young man who wandered about by himself. Unlike the others, Mr. Mayberry wasn't in uniform. His suit, well cut and expensive, fit perfectly. He had blue eyes, dark wavy hair, and a neat mustache, and moved with ease and confidence. The girls discussed him in whispers. Mr. Mayberry was a bit of a mystery. Nobody knew much about him. One rumor had it that he was the heir of a wealthy Boston family who had been disowned for having Confederate sympathies. Another claimed the opposite. He was from a large Georgia plantation and had to leave home because he favored the Union cause. Neither story was correct. The mysterious Mr. Mayberry was actually Emma on a new assignment, wearing another of her many faces. Back at the Union camp, General Hooker's aide had explained the situation. When the war began, three states, Maryland, Missouri, and Kentucky, were known as border states. Though they were slaveholding areas, they formed a kind of buffer zone between the North and the South. People in Kentucky were about evenly divided. They supported slavery, but didn't want to secede and destroy the Union. It was a dilemma, and Kentucky tried to solve it by staying neutral. Then, in August of 1862, General Kirby Smith invaded the state with a rebel army. Washington answered by sending General Ulysses Grant and his troops to occupy the key town of Paducah. With war on its doorstep, neutrality for Kentucky was impossible, and the state finally went over to the Union side. But wars aren't fought only on battlefields. Louisville became a center of undercover activity. Because of the divided feelings, there were many Southern sympathizers, as well as agents who fed valuable data to the rebel leaders in Richmond. General Hooker wanted to stop all these leaks, and once again, Franklin Thompson was called in.
"This time," the aide said to Private Thompson, "you'll work as a detective, not a spy. You won't be operating behind enemy lines, but in our own territory, among friends."
The major tapped a street plan of Louisville on the map board.
"This town is crawling with informers. Somehow the rebels know every blasted move we make. We know their main agent is feeding them facts every day. He's brilliant and very cagey. Your job, Thompson, is to find out who the devil he is."
The officer scribbled a name and address on a slip of paper and passed it to Thompson.
"This is your contact in Louisville. He'll supply you with funds, clothes, and so on. We can't use him for this job because he's too well known there. What we need is a total stranger, a man with brains and backbone."
He stood up and held out his hand.
"Keep your wits about you, Thompson. Get to know the pro-Southerners in Louisville. Take plenty of time, keep your eyes open, and don't get shot."
Franklin tackled the new job with confidence. In Louisville, he met his secret contact, creating the new identity of Charles Mayberry. Then he rented a room in a boarding house run by a woman said to have rebel sympathies. This had advantages for Mayberry. It tagged him as a possible Confederate supporter and gave him a chance to listen in on the other borders. Through his contact, he began to meet the city's important people and gradually to build an image. He played his role carefully, tactfully, and by the time of the gala dance, Mr. Mayberry had gained a toehold in Louisville society. By then, he also had a fairly good idea of the city's pro-Southern groups. But sympathy and political opinions didn't add up to treason. The chief Confederate agent, the man Mayberry was after, remained a total mystery. At the statehouse dance, Charles strolled about in his fine suit, bowing graciously to his acquaintances. Now and then, he casually stroked his mustache, pressing it gently to make sure the spirit gum would keep it in place. Later, he went into the refreshment room and helped himself to a sandwich. Nearby, at the end of the long table, he spotted P.N. Aylesworth, A short, round man with auburn mutton chop whiskers and fat, ruddy cheeks. Aylesworth, said to be very pro-Reb, didn't know it, but he was part of Mayberry's developing plan.
Enjoying the party, Mayberry.
Indeed I am, sir, Charles replied, remembering to keep his voice in a low key. Especially the food.
He gulped his sandwich hungrily and reached for another. Out of the corner of his eye, he saw Aylesworth watching and could guess what he was thinking. These young blades, easy come, easy go, no idea how to handle their money. Look at him, half starved.
Mr. Aylesworth, Charles said between mouthfuls, I have a bit of a problem. I wondered, sir, if I could stop by to see you tomorrow.
The fat man smiled.
Sure, Mayberry. Come round to the office first thing in the morning. We'll talk then.
Aylesworth was a wealthy dry goods merchant with a large, busy shop in Louisville. He also had contracts to supply Union regiments with blankets and uniforms. Early the following morning, Mr. Mayberry visited the shop and was directed to the owner's office in back. Aylesworth greeted him, then lit a cigar and leaned back at his roll-top desk. Pretending embarrassment, Mayberry said,
Sir, I find myself a bit short of funds and needful of employment. I write a very fine hand and am good with sums. I thought just possibly there might be some opening for me here.
Aylesworth, his eyes keen, questioned the young man in detail about his background and opinions. To play safe, Mayberry mixed truth with fiction. He told Aylesworth he was born in Canada on a large, prosperous farm. After his education, he'd come to America to make his way. He'd worked in various cities as a salesman, and now, winding up in Louisville, was out of funds and in need of a job. He also let slip a hint that his war sympathies were very much with the South. The merchant squinted and scratched his chin. It just so happened that his old bookkeeper was leaving and had to be replaced, as Mayberry already knew. At last, Aylesworth nodded.
I'll give you a chance, Mayberry. But mind you, it's only a trial. If you want to stay here, you'll have to prove yourself.
Mayberry thanked him gratefully and began to learn his new duties. For the next week, the young man worked very hard, always first at his desk in the morning and last to leave at night. The company's bills and ledgers were in a mess, and he was able to bring order out of the chaos, which pleased his busy employer. Aylesworth was so impressed with Mayberry that he even allowed him to handle an important sale, a big consignment of blankets to a nearby army post. Riding on the wagon next to the driver, Mayberry worried that someone at the Union camp would recognize him and give the game away. But he needn't have fretted. With his fine mustache, dark civilian suit, and round bowler hat, he had no trouble passing. He left the shipment at the quartermaster depot, arranged for payments and receipts, then returned to Louisville. After this success, Aylesworth began to rely heavily on him. He had a free run of the shop and stockrooms, as well as the account books. Watching the people come and go, Charles also learned what he'd suspected. Aylesworth and company was a clearinghouse for undercover rebel activities. He still couldn't put his finger on any hard evidence, but felt he was on the right track. Aylesworth had one special friend, a tall, lanky, sour-looking man named Hall. He and the merchant had secret dealings. They would often closet themselves in the office with the door carefully closed and locked. Mayberry was anxious to eavesdrop on these little meetings, but knew it would be too risky to try. Meanwhile, time was passing. At night, lying awake on the lumpy boarding house bed, Emma plagued herself with questions. Who was the gloomy Mr. Hall? Was he the man she was after? How could she find out? Where would she get the evidence she needed? Emma liked to make decisions and act on them. She hated the idea of personal failure, but she couldn't seem to break through the shell of secrecy. Another frustrating week went by with no results. Then she came up with a wild plan. It was unusual, daring and dangerous, but it just might bring matters to a head. It might also, if something went wrong, cost Charles Mayberry
his life.
Chapter 14, March 10th, 1863. The next morning, Charles waited until the shop was quiet and there were no customers to attend to. He tapped gently on Aylesworth's door, popped his head in, and asked for a word in private. Curious, the man waved him to a chair.
What can I do for you, Mayberry?
The young man cleared his throat nervously.
I've come to a big decision, sir, he said in a low voice.
The fact is, I've decided to join the Confederate Army.
Aylesworth's bushy eyebrows shot up.
Bless my soul. Are you sure about this?
Mayberry nodded.
Yes, sir. It was no hasty decision. I've been thinking about it a long time. You know that my sympathies have always been with the South. Now I really want to do my part for the cause.
The merchant frowned.
War is no lark, boy. You realize you could be killed.
Mayberry shook his head.
I'm prepared, Mr. Aylesworth. This is something I just have to do. I thought it out and have no choice, but I know it isn't easy to manage. I hoped, sir, maybe you'd be able to help me in some way.
Aylesworth lit a cigar, leaned back, and stared at the ceiling.
This comes as a surprise, Mayberry. We'll miss you in the shop, but I understand the need. Yes, indeed.
He went to the door and peeped out to make sure nobody was listening. Then he returned to the desk and lowered his voice.
If you're serious, I can help you. Tomorrow, leave the shop at your customary time. Come back shortly before 9 o'clock. You'll find 2 horses out back, saddled and ready.
Will you be my guide, sir? Charles asked.
Aylesworth shook his head.
I believe you know my friend, Mr. Hall. Well, he has certain dealings with the Confederacy. Has some, let us say, important documents to deliver. You can ride along with him. Hall has a secret route. From Louisville, you'll head south toward Garnetsville, and at one point a barge will ferry you across the river to the southern lines.
He patted Mayberry on the shoulder.
I admire your spirit, lad. Good luck with your plan, and not a word to anyone.
The young man's heart was racing. For the rest of the day, he had trouble concentrating on the books and ledgers of Aylesworth and Company. But quitting time came at last. Making sure he wasn't being followed, he hurried to meet his contact. When Mayberry explained what he'd done, the contact grinned with approval and told him to follow through carefully on the arrangements.
Leave with Hall, just as planned, he said. Somewhere on the Garnetsville Road, you'll walk right into a Union ambush. Of course, we'll have to arrest you both to make it look good, but have no fear, Thompson. You've done splendidly. I believe we've got our man at last.
The following evening was moonless and overcast. Just before 9, Mayberry slipped into the yard behind the shop. Hall and Aylesworth were already there with the horses. Even in the darkness, Charles could sense the tall man eyeing him with suspicion.
I don't like this, P.N.,
he muttered angrily.
Who is this fellow anyway? No need to worry, Hall,
the merchant said.
It's very safe. I'll vouch for the boy.
Finally, the agent shrugged and swung up in the saddle. As he did, Mayberry noticed the butt of a heavy Colt 44 pistol poking from Hall's belt. He mounted his own horse, praying that nothing would go wrong and that the planned ambush would work. Together, the riders turned south out of town and trotted along at a steady pace. Hall remained grim and silent. Now and then he cast an evil, sidelong glance at his young companion. Mayberry tried to make small talk, but finally gave up, and they rode for over an hour without speaking a word. The night was still, and Charles was beginning to get worried. Where were the Union troopers? Had something gone wrong with their timing? What would he do if the scheme failed? Soon he could hear Hall muttering anxiously to himself. At any moment, the man could pull his gun, shoot him, and dump his body in the river.
and no one would be any the wiser. Mayberry's tension kept slowly building. Sweat trickled down his back. In the darkness, Hall seemed to grow bigger and more menacing, a grim image foretelling doom. Charles fought to stay cool and composed. Under his breath, he began to recite a beloved psalm to calm himself. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. A loud command tore through the silence.
Raise your hands, both of you!
The spy almost whooped with relief as a squad of Union cavalrymen burst through the trees and surrounded them. Both travelers raised their hands as the captain in charge rode up and yanked the gun from Hall's belt.
Tie 'em with their hands behind their backs, he barked.
Mayberry and Hall were quickly trussed, and in this ungainly manner, they turned off the road and headed toward a nearby Union encampment. They were now circled by the troopers, and Hall made no attempt to escape. But Charles could still hear him muttering, cursing the Union, the entire government in Washington, and mostly his own bad luck. Safe in camp, Hall was locked up, and Mayberry was released with the thanks of the captain. Worn out, he found a quiet place to sleep. The next day, he reported to Hooker's aide at headquarters. The officer beamed at him.
We caught him with the goods, Thompson. Those documents he had were secret Union plans he was taking to the rebels. In his papers, we also found the names of two other agents in Louisville, a sutler and a traveling photographer. They've been nabbed, along with Aylesworth. A clean sweep. You couldn't have done better.
Back at his own regiment, Private Thompson was praised and congratulated. And on General Hooker's orders, he was presented with yet another trophy, a handsome engraved sword taken from a Confederate major during the Battle of Fair Oaks near Richmond. Later, at the chaplain's quarters, Emma described the whole adventure to Mrs. Butler. She gave her the engraved sword for safekeeping, to be left with the rifle she'd brought back from Yorktown.
Land sakes, all these trophies, Mrs. Butler exclaimed. I'm beginning to run out of room.
The two women laughed. Neither of them knew it, but this would be the last of Emma's hard-won souvenirs. More trouble was lying ahead for her, but it was of a different kind. Chapter 15, May 6th, 1863. A few weeks after the Louisville episode, the regiment was transferred again, this time to Vicksburg and the army of General Grant. Vicksburg, on the east bank of the Mississippi River, was a Confederate rail center. If the Union could capture it, the Southern forces would be almost cut in two. But the city was well defended, guarded by river and swamplands on one side and steep, craggy bluffs on the other. The rebels' main defense was a system of trenches stretching for miles, from Haines's Bluff to the Warrenton Road. Since Grant's men far outnumbered the defenders, he tried to storm these trenches directly. But the rebels under General John Pemberton, fighting skillfully, beat off every attack and left the Union with thousands of casualties. Finally, Grant was forced to dig in, and a long siege began. Vicksburg was sealed off on the riverside by Union warships. On the land side, Union artillery bombarded it with endless shells. Little by little, a noose of steel tightened around the besieged city. Later, a Confederate soldier wrote home that even a cat couldn't have crept out of Vicksburg without being discovered. All this caused great suffering on both sides. The cannonading killed hundreds of soldiers and civilians inside the wrecked and starving city. Meanwhile, rebel sharpshooters, hidden on the bluffs, picked off great numbers of Union men. At times, the Federal troops had to crouch in trenches up to their knees in water, unable to raise their heads because of the hail of sniper bullets. During these nightmarish weeks, Private Thompson and the nurses worked without rest. The surgeons were completely exhausted. And Mrs. Butler, along with other officers' wives, came to the hospital daily to help tend the wounded. Then Emma's luck, which up till then had been so good, suddenly ran out. For some time she had been feeling sick, but had been too busy to do anything about it. Her symptoms became worse, and at last she had to face the truth. She was suffering from malaria, or swamp fever, as the soldiers called it. Dr. Hodes and his assistants dosed Private Thompson with quinine, but it did no good. The malaria was severe. 1 minute he burned with fever, the next he shook with a terrible chill. He could hardly sleep or eat, and found himself getting weaker by the day. Finally, Thompson applied for leave but gave no details, and his request was turned down. In this crisis, headquarters needed every single skilled nurse, and that was that. Desperate, Emma turned to her trusted friend. "What should I do?" she wailed, sitting in Mrs. Butler's tent, shivering in an army blanket. "I can't just climb into a bed in the hospital. If I take my clothes off, they'll know my secret. I'll be finished." Mrs. Butler paced the little tent unhappily. "I don't know what to say, my dear. You're very sick. You have to be hospitalized. Sakes, I'd nurse you here if I could, but there's no room. Besides, the major would learn the truth. He'd feel it his duty to report you to headquarters." In tears, the women embraced each other. Then Emma trudged back to the hospital, feeling hopeless. She was ill and confused. Her world was splintering. Her imp voice was silent. For 2 years, she'd posed as a man and had played the part well. To give it all up now, to be glaringly exposed, was a painful humiliation. Somehow, to Emma's fevered mind, it would shame her and make a joke of everything she'd tried to do. She remembered feeling this same kind of deep hopelessness when she was 16. Then she'd solved the problem by running away. Now, again, flight seemed the best way out. The only way out. Yes, she would leave quietly, get the help she needed, and come back to Vicksburg when she was stronger. For Emma, to decide on something was to act on it. She left a brief note for Mrs. Butler, explaining her plans and asking her to please look after Rebel. Then she packed her kit, took the money she'd saved, and slipped out of the nurses' quarters. Before dawn, she hitched a ride out of camp on a drover's cart. Later, near Steele's Bayou, she took passage on a Mississippi riverboat and headed north to Cairo, Illinois. Cairo was a bustling town, big enough to boast a hospital. Emma, weak and shaky, managed to buy a skirt, blouse, and bonnet. In a rented room, she changed from a Union soldier back to plain Miss Edmonds. Then she went to the hospital and signed herself in for treatment. Emma remained in bed for several weeks, and with the proper food, rest, and medical care, gradually recovered. She followed the war news eagerly and learned that Vicksburg had surrendered. At the same time, an army under General George Meade defeated Lee's forces in the Battle of Gettysburg. These two events helped the Union turn a corner. Victory was still a distant dream, but was beginning to come closer. Emma sensed the turn of the tide, and with her malaria under control, planned to rejoin her old outfit. Instead, she received another blow. Scanning the army bulletins in the window of the Cairo newspaper office, she saw that Private Franklin Thompson of the 2nd Michigan was listed as AWOL, absent without leave. In the army's books, she had been branded a deserter. For Emma Edmonds, a door suddenly slammed shut. Now there was no way she could take up her old work as a field nurse, courier, and Union spy. Private Thompson was considered a deserter. He couldn't protest without an investigation, in which the secret would surely come out. For a time, Emma was heartsick. Then she reacted to this setback, the way she always did, with action. Frank Thompson might be finished, but the war was still on, and there were many ways she could be useful. She sent word to Mrs. Butler, telling her what had happened. Then, with the last of her funds, bought a train ticket to Washington. After her 2 years away, she found the capital more hectic and chaotic than ever. Wounded men were pouring in, and here, far from the fighting fronts, good nurses were badly needed. She found a place to live and went quickly to work in one of the base hospitals. For the remainder of the war, Emma served as a nurse under her rightful name, tending and comforting the wounded. Now and then, she would run into a trooper from Vicksburg or Yorktown and would ply him with questions about friends and acquaintances. She also followed in detail the battles of those final years. Chickamauga, Missionary Ridge, Spotsylvania, the Wilderness, Atlanta, Petersburg. Emma exulted in each Union victory and wept for the dead and dying of both sides. Early in April of 1865, government troops finally occupied the battered rebel capital of Richmond. On the 9th of that same month, General Lee surrendered the Confederate armies to Ulysses Grant, and at last, the long ordeal was over. 2 days later, Abraham Lincoln made a speech from a window of the White House. The president, gaunt and weary, spoke of peace and honor, of charity and the healing of wounds. Among those in the huge crowd who cheered themselves hoarse was Emma Edmonds. The Sunday after the South surrendered happened to be Easter, and Emma went to church. One of the songs that morning was an Easter hymn she'd always loved. As she sang with the others, she realized it could have been written for that very time in history. The strife is o'er, the battle done, the victory of life is won. Our song of triumph has begun. Alleluia. Looking back at the years of war, she thought of all the people she'd known and the roles she'd played. When she first enlisted in Michigan, it was a kind of lark. She'd had little idea what lay ahead, but she'd met all the challenges and done her best. Emma's heart was full. Her beloved land was finally at peace. Now it was time for the healing. Chapter 16. What happened after? What became of Emma Edmonds after the Great Civil War ended? Government records and pension files offer some answers. For a time, she kept on with her nursing work. She also sat down and wrote her memoirs, describing some of her adventures as Private Thompson. In all, Emma spent 2 years as a man in the Union Army and made 11 different trips behind rebel lines. On those spy missions, she used various disguises, but her favorite was always the spunky little black slave named Cuff. Her story came out soon after the end of hostilities. Titled Nurse and Spy in the Union Army, her book proved a big success and sold thousands of copies. Emma donated her share of the profits to U.S. War Relief. The tale is hard to read because it is written in the fancy, flowery style popular in those days. But the reasons for what Emma Edmonds did are simple and clear. On the first page, she says, "It was not my intention or desire to seek my own personal ease and comfort while so much sorrow and distress filled the land. But the great question to be decided was, what can I do? What part can I myself play in this great drama?" Morals in 19th century America were prim and proper, and some people thought Emma's actions very shocking. But the publisher, W.S. Williams of Hartford, Connecticut, added a gallant note of defense. Should any of her readers object to some of her disguises, it may be sufficient to remind them it was from the purest motives and most praiseworthy patriotism that she laid aside for a time her own costume and assumed that of the opposite sex, enduring hardships, suffering untold privations, and hazarding her life for her adopted country in its trying hour of need. The little volume came out over 120 years ago. It has long since disappeared from our bookshelves and libraries, but surprisingly, a few ancient copies still exist. Their bindings are falling apart. The pages are torn and brown with age, yet Emma's adventures are as fresh and exciting as any tale of modern courage. After finishing her writing, Emma grew homesick and went back to visit St. John, Canada. There, she met Linus Seeley, an old friend from her childhood days. A romance soon began, and in 1867, Emma and Linus returned to the United States to be married in Cleveland, Ohio. Linus was a mechanic, and the Seeleys traveled a lot in connection with his work. They went from Ohio to Michigan to Illinois, finally settling in Fort Scott, Kansas. The couple had three sons, one of whom later joined the U.S. Army, just like Mama did. But Emma never fully recovered from her malaria, which she apparently first caught in the Chickahominy swamps. Her health slowly grew worse. She also began to brood about the shame of being branded as a deserter. Considering all she'd been through, she felt it a cruel, unfair label. She got in touch with officers from her old regiment and asked for their help. Encouraged by them, Emma petitioned the War Department for a full review of her case. She asked to have her military rights restored, including any back pay, plus an honorable discharge. The matter was debated in Washington, D.C., and on July 5, 1884, a special act of Congress granted everything she asked for. Emma was awarded an honorable discharge, plus a bonus and a veteran's pension of $12 per month. By now, Mrs. Seeley had made contact with a number of old Army friends, including the butlers. She kept in touch with them all and attended some of the regimental reunions. Most of her fellow troopers were, of course, amazed to learn that this plump, matronly lady in her fancy bonnet and long skirts was none other than their slim, cool-eyed war buddy, Frank Thompson. In 1891, Emma's son Frederick was married and moved to the town of LaPorte, Texas. Emma and Linus soon joined the young couple there. They liked the southern climate and stayed in LaPorte until Emma's death on September 5, 1898. Today, her simple grave is in the military section of Washington Cemetery in Houston, Texas. After the war, a group of Civil War veterans who had seen action in the Union forces formed a society called the Grand Army of the Republic. The GAR became powerful and important in American life and had a huge enrollment of over 400,000 ex-soldiers. The only female member of this honored group was Emma Edmonds. This concludes the reading of Behind Rebel Lines, The Incredible Story of Emma Edmonds, Civil War Spy, by Seymour Reed. Copyright 1988 by Seymour Reed. This book was read by Tavia Gilbert, a member of SAG-AFTRA. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Writers House, LLC, and was produced in 2019 by Blackstone Publishing, which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.